I'm going to call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order, and looks like we do have a quorum. Let the record reflect that the time is currently 1:34 p.m. on Tuesday, March 27th, 2018. Present today, we have Representative Ortiz, Representative Kawasaki, Representative Wilson, Representative Tilton, Representative Gren, Representative Guttenberg, Representative Thompson, and myself, Co-Chair Foster. And before we start, just a reminder, if folks could mute their cell phones. And today in committee, we will have the confirmation hearing of the Department of Revenue Commissioner Designee Sheldon Fisher and the introduction of two bills, HB 233, Education Tax Credits, Sunset and Repeals, and HB 303, which is Workers' Compensation, Rehabilitation, and Reemployment. So we will go ahead and get started with the confirmation hearing for Commissioner Designee of the Department of Revenue, Sheldon Fisher. And Commissioner Fisher, if you could come to the table and put yourself on the record and go ahead and maybe give an introduction if you have one. Otherwise, we can jump right into questions. And let's see here. So with that, first of all,
Mr. Right.
Commissioner, if you could put yourself on the record.
Thank you. My name is Sheldon Fisher, and I currently serve as the Commissioner Designee from the Department of Revenue, and I am delighted to be here, both in this capacity and in this meeting today. As you know, I served prior to this most recent position. I was the Commissioner for the Department of Administration for the prior 3 years with the Governor. Just to give you a little sense, I thought I would talk a little bit about some of the work we did there, and I think that will illuminate some of my values, and then I thought I would share a few thoughts about the current Department of Revenue and my responsibilities there. Within the Department of Administration, we attempted to focus primarily on how we could drive more efficient delivery of government services. By and large, our customers at the Department of Administration are other departments within the state, and so in that role, we implemented and started the process of implementing what we refer to as shared services, which was an attempt to gather together similar functions that historically had been performed in each individual department and put them into a common organization with the goal of driving improvement in process and streamlining both cost and driving efficiencies. We're in the process, that is an ongoing work in progress that is continuing to happen in the department. We also consolidated the Office of Information Technology for the state into a single office that I think is also driving both improved delivery of services and as well as reduced costs. Beyond that, we have attempted to develop and provide resources across the state to deliver process improvement expertise so that any department in the state can consider how they do business and try to improve it. And just one example that I'm particularly pleased with was within the Department of Motor or the Division of Motor Vehicles, we examined the way work was being done, and with no additional resources, no additional capital investment, just purely through streamlining processes and improving the way work gets done, we're able to reduce the wait time from an average wait time of almost 43 minutes to actually below 13 minutes for across the state. And so I believe in process improvement. I believe that there are opportunities, and I think there always will be. That is an initiative or an effort that should never end. There's always opportunity to improve. Turning a little bit now to the Department of Revenue and my thoughts about the current department, I am concerned within the state that we have too much uncertainty, too much fiscal uncertainty, and that it has a harmful impact on our state economy. In the short time I've been in this role, I've spoken to bankers, I've spoken to major businesses in the state, and many of them, either their customers or they themselves, view the degree of uncertainty as negatively impacting their willingness to invest more in Alaska. And so I think that we share, you, the administration, the legislature share a common goal and a common interest to attempt to provide as much certainty as possible. And I think we, at least I believe that the first step in that direction is to begin to use the permanent fund. We sometimes refer to this as POMV, or percent of market value. I think that that's inevitably going to be part of a fiscal solution, and it seems that there is a consensus around that. And so I am a strong proponent and supporter of a rational, sustainable POMV structure to help reduce the uncertainty. That alone, in my judgment, will not be enough to close the fiscal gap, but it will substantially reduce the uncertainty, and I think will prompt a degree of investment that will be important to our state. Beyond that, I also have, I think, been on the record in prior meetings that I believe that the state would do well to broaden its tax base, and that, in fact, we are too reliant on a single base of the oil industry to support the revenue of the state, and I think we would do well to have a broader tax base that again would provide more certainty and less variability in terms of the revenue for the state. And then beyond some of those principles, there are a number of things I'm supporting now. As you know, the oil and gas tax credit bond bill is, again, another attempt at trying to provide more certainty and more consistency within the state and between the state and some of the businesses here, so that businesses can rely on those on the state's position and make investment decisions that hopefully will put Alaskans back to work. I hope one of my principles that I hope you will always see from me is I will try to be as honest and transparent and complete as I can be. I respect the role of the legislature. I think that that the decisions that you make are critically important, and I think they belong to you. And our role, oftentimes, I see my role as presenting information. While I may be advocating for a particular position, I also view my role as providing a balanced presentation that allows you to fulfill your role and make rational and appropriate decisions. And that's the end of my introductory remarks, but I'm happy to answer any questions that anyone may have.
Thank you, Commissioner Designee Fisher. Just for the record, I want to note that Representative Pruitt, Vice Chair Guerra, and Co-Chair Seaton have also joined us. And so with that, let's go ahead and open it up for questions. Does the committee have any questions? Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And thank you for being here and for wanting to be the Commissioner of Revenue. You were talking about that you think that we need to have more revenue sources, and you were talking about taxes. Is a certain tax rise to a level to where it would have less negative impact on our constituents?
Through the chair, I understand your question is, do I believe that there's a certain type of tax that is preferable because of the revenue received versus the impact on the economy? Is that a fair characterization of your question? I don't come to that discussion with a recommendation. I think that various taxes have different characteristics. They impact different segments of the economy, of the populace. Some we all like to also be able to tax different groups depending on non-citizen groups, and so in some places the non-resident workers, certain taxes will collect from them. Other taxes might result in more money being raised from visitors that come, and so each tax has its merits and its challenges, and that's something that as you consider different taxes, we'd be happy to support that. I don't necessarily come to this discussion with a preferred tax that I would recommend.
And a follow-up, Mr. Chairman?
Follow-up.
So what process would you go through? I mean, as you said, you know, it affects everybody differently, each portion of that. Are there studies that have been done from the administration level at this point, as we've been talking about it for the last couple of years? What kind of information can you as commissioner bring to us to have a better understanding, because we're so diversified here in Alaska, on the impacts of any type of, not just necessarily new taxes, but we've also had in front of us increase in for fishing, motor fuel tax, mining, all those sorts of taxes. And I have felt through the years that we really haven't been given a lot of information that could be justified on the impact, whether or not the money we would get would actually slow the economy down to a certain point to where we literally would get less than what we even thought.
So through the chair, as you know, we presented in the special session a certain amount of information about a wage tax and contrasted that with a few other tax in terms of the segments that would be impacted and some information. It sounds like, based on your statement, that you don't feel like you've received adequate information, that the information we've submitted isn't sufficient. And so that's something that when it's appropriate, if it's appropriate now, we'd be delighted to kind of sit down and let's work together on the right set of questions, and we'll diligently try to pull the information. Some of it we may be able to gather ourselves. Some of it may require that we source and gather the information from other sources, but we'd have no discomfort with pulling as much as we can and sharing it with you.
Can I follow up, Mr. Chairman?
Follow up.
And on the flip side, so we are a resource-rich state. Have you been working with DNR on other major projects, whether that has to do with mining, the opening up of ANWR, other type of opportunities, so our revenue is not being generated from Alaskans necessarily, but getting our not just our product sent out of state, which we seem to be good at, versus actually utilizing those resources, the raw material here, and having those get good paying jobs here.
So through the chair, your question is, have we been working with DNR can you rephrase your question?
Mr. Chairman.
All right.
So we're always talking about taxes and how we can get more money out of Alaskans when we have more resources than any state could ever hope for. And since DNR is in charge of the majority of our resources and where they're located, has the Department of Revenue been looking at those areas, not just with DNR, but the university has land, Middle Health Trust has land that's not necessarily being utilized to its best? Are you looking at how we could better not just develop the resources that we have and getting them out of the ground, but the potential of being able to take those raw materials and turning them into an actual product?
So through the chair, I think it's fair to say that we've spent, and this predates my participation, but the department has spent a fair amount of time thinking about the tax policy of those various different sectors. We probably have done less thinking about the economic development strategy for those sectors, and so that's something we probably need to think about collectively as an administration and decide where that sits and how we attack that issue.
That would be a nice change. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Question from Representative Guerra.
Thanks, Chair. I've got a few questions. Commissioner, I'm not going to ask you what your position is, but just let me address the state's oil tax system. I received a memo from Tax Director Alper last year that says on so-called new fields, the GVR fields, we receive no production taxes whatsoever for the average new field at prices below $73 a barrel. Is that something that you know about or can comment on?
So through the chair, I'm not familiar with the memo that you're referring to and haven't looked at that deeply. I believe that as I said before, I think the right next step for the state is to broaden the tax base. I think that the question of whether or not we need to revisit the regime, the oil and gas tax regime, is it a question that seems to be present frequently in the legislature? And my goal would be to pursue a process where that is addressed in a manner that I think is fair both to the state and to the oil companies, but that can provide a sense of confidence to both that it will not be a ever-evolving question that will be addressed session after session. I think that we would do well as a state to, again, broaden the sources of tax revenue, but acknowledging that there may be components of the regime that you've discussed that should be addressed, but still doing it in a way that attempts to provide a long-term solution to the problem.
Through the chair.
Follow up?
Yeah, I'll just represent to you the memo, and I can stand corrected but I've got it memorized. So for the average North Slope field, the so-called new oil pays no production taxes at all at prices below $73 a barrel for the average field. And ANWR has been opened, and that's going to be new oil. And so for 7 years at prices below $73 a barrel, we'll get no production taxes. Do you think that's a reasonable tax policy?
I'll be honest with you. I haven't looked deeply into this, and I'd be uncomfortable making a statement. I would rather pursue a process where we examine the entire regime and in a thoughtful way that results in a regime that we all agree is fair and sustainable long-term so that the state and the industry can rely upon it.
Representative Guerra.
Thank you. And I'll get you the memo, I would say that I think the two most unstable oil taxes are ones that are too high and ones that are too low because they're always going to be changed. And right now, we believe we're at one that's too low, and that's why it's unstable. Representative Wilson asked you about jobs and the economy. $2.3 billion deficit, if we had an average capital budget, which right now we're on an austerity capital budget, if we had an average capital budget, that would be about $500 million. And so under the ICER study, which I think you're probably aware of, if we, by reducing that capital budget by that $300 million, we lose about 3,000 or 4,500 jobs, is that correct, under the ICER study?
That's in line with my memory as well, yes.
And through the chair.
Representative Guerra.
If we're just going to be on a trajectory of running out of money, one of the impacts of saying, look, no taxes, could be just continued job losses from budget cuts and budget reductions. Is that fair to say?
Well, I think that you know that the administration and we supported a more sustainable, more meaningful capital budget in the governor's budget this year. It was a multi-year budget that was intended to address deferred maintenance. The reason we chose deferred maintenance was both because it impacts every community, so it would be broadly distributed across the state. It doesn't increase the footprint of the state. In other words, we're not buying assets that future generations will have to maintain. Instead, it's maintaining those assets we currently have. And unlike some mega projects, deferred maintenance tends to be performed by local businesses. It tends to be our own Alaskan businesses that predominantly will perform that deferred maintenance. And so that proposal was, in fact, supported by a broad-based tax. I think we can discuss the flavor of that broad-based tax, but it was supported by a broad-based tax, and I think we believe that was an important opportunity for the state to expand our economic base and help us out of this the challenging times that we're in.
Thanks, Commissioner. Thank you, Chair. I probably have one other round later on, but you should go around the table.
Any further questions, Representative Grin?
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Commissioner Fisher, you mentioned the the oil tax bonding bill that is coming from the administration. Could you talk a little bit about your involvement with the perhaps the genesis of the idea and the process of how it, of how the bill was created?
Sure, through the chair. Early on, the governor came to me and said that he was would like to see if we could find a solution for the oil tax credits. And so I suggested to him that I would try to develop a set of alternatives that I thought might be able to address that concern. And when what I understood the governor to be asking me, at least, was that he felt like we needed to find a solution that provided I don't mean to overstate the word, but certainty to the industry so they could rely on it and they could receive their payment in a timely fashion that allowed them to go back to work. And so we considered, I used a number of resources there in the department that has some expertise in kind of thinking about financial instruments and ways that they might be used to pay this off. And when I started, I was hoping to have multiple solutions where maybe there were other alternatives just than to go to Wall Street, maybe different funds that are available to the state would be available. But as we kind of dug into the program and how it might work, we ultimately concluded that the only solution, at least that we could come up with, that we thought was prudent was the one we proposed. And the reason I say that is that the other funds that we considered all seemed to have a, there was a concern associated with it. And in particular, this is a fairly large chunk of money, and so if you think about this as an investment, say, for the Jafonzi or some other PC or something like that, it was too large. It was too large a percentage of the overall fund to satisfy the prudent investment rule. And so we ended up with this solution as the one that we thought both would could work and that was rational for the state. It didn't concentrate this obligation in a single place that was imprudent, and so we this is kind of where we ended up, and the governor accepted the proposal.
Representative Kawasaki.
Thank you. Thank you, Commissioner, for being here today, and I just wanted to say thanks because we had been talking about for eight or 9 years on shared services or ways to consolidate functions, and that really has happened under your watch, and that's That was a really important step forward, and we hope it continues to go forward. I had one thing I just wanted to read and then ask your opinion on, if I could. It says, every organization recognizes that budgeting is a process of ranking priorities and making choices. Do we buy a new car or pay for soccer for children? Is this the year for a new snow machine or a new washing machine? Each of us must live within our means. That's an excerpt from something that you wrote in 2010. And it was
sounds great, doesn't it?
It does sound great. What I wanted to ask you in terms so the legislature, we budget, we write the budget. You're one of your major roles is to make sure that we have enough revenue to meet those expenditures. So my question for you is so you don't get to design the budget, you get to design your internal budget, but what do you think of the size of the state operating budget at this time?
So that's an interesting question. I have said publicly, and I hope this is, I think this is consistent with where the administration's at, that if you look at the divisions, the departments, I like to take the departments are, I like to take the budget and I like to put them into three categories. One is formula programs. I'll talk about that in a moment. Another is life, health, safety, and we can talk about that. Maybe there's four. Then there's education, and then there's the other departments. And the other departments are like my department and administration where I was and health and social services and commerce and transportation, all those departments. And, when you think about, and it's my impression, at least, that when people think about government, they think about those departments. And there's, I think, this view that there's a lot of opportunity to continue to reduce costs. And most of those departments on a UGF basis have had cuts somewhere between 30% and 40%. And on a UGF plus DGF, it's probably closer to, on average, about 25%. And it's my view that while I will always agree, and I said it before, there's always an opportunity to do to be more efficient. There's always an opportunity to do things better. But I think that within those department budgets, that's an ever-declining opportunity. And let's take my department right now, the Department of Revenue. We have a handful of groups. We've got the tax group that does audits and those sort of things. And I'm persuaded that if we tried to cut from that department, we would actually collect fewer taxes. So we would be penny wise and pound foolish because we would cut and we would lose more in revenue than we cut. Another department or another division is the permanent fund division, which distributes the permanent fund to individuals. But we're moving aggressively in that department to really move towards online filings, and we see that as an opportunity. I can go into why, how that will save money. But that's not without some cost to the state. In other words, there's some people today that I think for whatever reason find filing online to be less advantageous. And so as we move towards that solution, we'll find that there are certain people who feel like government is not serving them as well as it did in the past. And then, you know, we've got a division that collects payments, child support payments, and that is largely funded with federal matching funds or federal receipts. There's a modest amount of state funding for that. But my point in all of this is that I don't see in my budget massive inefficiencies. There's small things we can do and we should do and we should continue to do that will improve that. Now, let's talk about then the other places, life, health, safety. I think there is a sense within Alaskans that we need to maybe devote more to that or at least not cut that more. Education, my own view is that Alaskans would like to see better outcomes for their money they're spending, but I don't see a strong desire to actually cut education. The one place that I see an opportunity, and this is turns again to some work that we did at the Department of Administration as I was ending my time there, is healthcare. I think that there is an opportunity for some interesting strategies around healthcare, and I encourage the administration and would encourage the legislature to continue that dialogue and to really look at what we can do to improve healthcare costs and how that can save money. It impacts the amount that we spend on education. A big chunk of that is spent on healthcare. It impacts our retirement, our pension obligations. It impacts our own state employees. And then, in addition, I think that challenges with the healthcare impact the growth of the economy as a whole because it impacts the private sector. So that's the place that I would really look for opportunities to save.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Guttenberg.
Oh, I didn't realize I was so fast in the queue, but thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, in DMV, you guys did a great job, right? If you live in an urban area, you're able to get online and see what the line is at Department of Motor Vehicles, whether you should run right down there now or go to the private sector who have, lack of a better term, subcontract a lot of that work, do it now for themselves. When I've talked to people in the department and I said, why haven't you done things like that more largely across the state? And I'll give you an example because I'm going into broadband because that's kind of where people expect me to go. The delivery of services, not just services to people, let's just say state employees. two troopers need to fly out someplace to deal with an issue someplace, bring somebody in. Things like that, with the ability to do this online, ability of state employees having to come in to do health care in town, to do all kinds of things internally, besides the efficiencies of moving IT into one place, which was a good idea, but doesn't address the larger issues, just dealing with state functioning amongst itself, abilities of employees to function from rural Alaska into urban Alaska, to create opportunities for the state to have more efficiencies. The courts have done it very well and saved a lot of money. But when I talk to people in admin, they say that's not our job. If it's not their job, whose is it, right? So, you know, when we deal with trooper travel and the number of times they have to travel someplace, or people in training in rural places that have to come in where they could do it online, I mean, there's a whole host of things. The lost opportunities when the FirstNet contract was awarded, I don't know if you had anything to do with that, but the state in a lot of rural Alaska is just at a loss for some initiative out there, and I think the state could take leadership on that, and I just haven't seen it being done. So I wonder if you could respond to that from your time as Commissioner of Admin.
So through the chair, first of all, I guess I hate it when someone says that's not my job, and I think that everybody has a role. But I want to suggest that I think we did actually, we have tried to improve efficiencies, and I'm not going to say that we've fixed everything, but in the Department of Administration, for example, we went through a process of streamlining the way we lease property and substantially reduce the time to turn around a lease, and I can go through kind of the details of that. But and in the meantime, we were both renegotiating leases to reduce cost in this environment, as well as trying to move out of space that was leased and consolidate and shrink the footprint and that sort of thing, and they have saved millions of dollars in that. I know that the Department of Transportation, which maintains the buildings in the state, has also developed a shared service model for building maintenance and has consolidated that into a single organization, and that has done things like they try when they're going to a community to gather up all the work that needs to be done and send a person or a group of people to do it all at once rather than kind of sending people out piecemeal over time. We did what we refer to as a Kaizen event, a process improvement event for DNR in terms of mining permits, because that was an area that was identified as a place where there was it was cumbersome and difficult. And so I do think that we have attempted, and actually DOA, Department of Administration, is the place where these resources exist, of developing a capacity to do a process improvement analysis where you look at the way things are done and you try to suggest and recommend and implement changes that will allow work to be done better. The mantra we like to use is better, faster, cheaper, so that you get better results, measurable better results, in a quicker time frame at a lower cost. And so that's not to say that there aren't continued ongoing need to drive efficiency and improvement. And I would argue that even General Electric, that has been an organization that has pioneered this for 20-plus years, they're still constantly looking for ways to improve. And so just because we've done some areas doesn't mean we don't need to continue. And I'm sure that you will always be able to find a place where the state could improve, and we need to develop a culture and a set of resources that allow that to happen.
I may, Mr. Chair.
Representative Guttberg.
Thank you. So I wouldn't say a consensus, but there's a feeling that the state itself is way behind the curve on technology, on broadband, delivering broadband and its ability. January before last, you hired a CIO, and I've talked with him a couple of times, and I keep waiting for the first time I spoke with him was that January when I realized that you had hired somebody, incredible resume, and I keep waiting for some vision or something to come out besides where we're pushing our IT people around so they're more efficient on fixing people's computers and printers. I mean, the state by itself, never mind the state in general, has a telecommunications infrastructure that is very old and antiquated, and I keep waiting for some report or something that has a vision, because these are not little efficiencies across the board and little cubbyholes of departments, but this is a significant issue in moving the state into tomorrow, which is some of tomorrow has passed already, and we're slow, and we're, the state's not hasn't responded. So I'm just, if you have a comment on that, I would appreciate it.
Through the chair, if I can follow up, when you refer to the state being antiquated, are you referring to the network of the state government, or are you referring to the telecommunication infrastructure of Alaska?
Actually, both separately or together.
So I actually think that the state's network is the state of the state government's network is not severely antiquated. One of the things that actually we did was to, and when I was at admin, was we actually rebuilt our core network. And again, we were able to do that without a capital appropriation. We were able to structure cost savings, and the vendor provided a financing instrument, and we use that financing instrument to buy the equipment and then use cost savings to pay that off. And so I think that that we could persuade you that while I don't know that I would call our state network cutting edge, I don't think it's antiquated. I think that they've done a pretty good job of trying to, at least the core network, of ensuring that it is functional and up to date is maybe a good way of saying that. Now, flipping sides though a little bit to the state of Alaska, Alaska as a whole, I don't necessarily disagree with you that we are struggling as a state to deliver adequate broadband services to all of our communities. And the big challenge, I think that you know, because I know you've studied this, is the middle mile. It's not, in many jurisdictions, it's the last mile is the weak link. In Alaska, it's really the middle mile. Much of rural America tends to have highly dispersed populations that it's difficult to deliver that last mile. We tend to have villages that are relatively densely populated in a location, and then a large distance to the next village, and we don't necessarily have these broad rural communities like other places in the country. And so it's that middle mile. And, you know, there was a broadband task force. I know that a number of people in the industry have spoken to you about it, and that's just first of all, it's a lot of money. I mean, I think the estimate is in excess of $1 billion to kind of build out and improve that middle mile network. And then the question is, are there better ways of using the money that's currently spent on telecommunications and perhaps improve that middle mile network? I think that is an important and relevant conversation that we should have. I'm not certain that the state CIO does have an impressive resume, and I'm sure would have a lot to contribute to that conversation. Part of maybe your frustration, at least the mandate that I gave him when I was running admin, was not necessarily to fix the state middle mile network, but rather to drive efficiencies and improvements out of the state government's network.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We can go on forever, but that's good.
Thank you. Maybe we'll take Representative Seaton as the last, with the last question. We do have a number of folks who have shown up today for invited testimony, as well as folks who want to do public testimony on the following two bills. So with that, Representative Seaton.
Thank you. And I wanted to focus on work as revenue and your philosophy there. And going, and of course, revenue is oil taxes. And so going back to the first time when I was here, we did significant work. We had worldwide consultant Daniel Johnson, and quoting from him, the world average government take, even right now, is probably 67 to 70 or 70%, depending on how you calculate it. And the Wood and McKinsey study is about 71%. And then in 07, we had Econ One doing the work for us in November of 07, and their charts show that at all prices, 40, 60, 80, we're looking in those same kinds of ranges, never dropping below 60 or going above 70%. And then in 2013, we looked at PFC Energy. In January 13, it was 62% for existing fields and 65% for new developments. And now we come to presentations by ConocoPhillips, and we have their 2017 producer share as a versus ANS West Coast. And at $65 a barrel, their share was 37%. So that's about one-third. And so two-thirds was the other share. And now we are in 2018, and at $65 a share, their share is 48%. So there's an 11% change in amount of producer share of the wealth of Alaska resources on the North Slope. And that's before you talk about any credits other than the per barrel credit, but we are, as you know, basically picking up 35% of all their expenses in the credits that they subtract from the taxes they pay to us. So I guess what I want to do is find out from you, do you think that increasing producer share of North Slope oil 11% in the last year is a position that you as the Commissioner of Revenue support, or do you propose any change in oil taxes to go back a little bit to every single tax system that we had considered from PPT to all of the other variations, and including the initial introduced SB 21 at 25% tax and no per barrel tax credit. Where is your philosophy as far as the amount of revenue that the producer gets to keep off the North Slope, and this 11% increase, not even including the credits they get to subtract from our portion?
So through the chair, I think that I'm guessing, and I have not been studying this in the way that you all have for the last number of years, but I'm guessing that you would see a wide range within those averages of different jurisdictions that have different cost structures and that divide their share up differently depending on the cost structure. It's hard for me to talk specifically. I'll be honest with you, I didn't come prepared to kind of address that change in share and to be able to talk cogently about how that fits within a larger regime. I think that as I understand this administration's position, is that we don't think that this is the right time to discuss changes in the oil tax regime. As I said before, I believe that the right solution is to broaden our tax base. I think ultimately that will lead to a more stable funding of state government and a resulting more stable economic environment. That doesn't necessarily mean that there won't ever be it wouldn't be the right time to revisit, but I think that the revisit the oil and gas tax regime, but I think that's potentially a future discussion, and I don't think that that this is the right time. I think there's been too many changes in our state in the near term that we shouldn't be revisiting that decision now. As I said before, I do believe that the state budget will require some additional revenue, and I think that the prudent thing would be to broaden our tax base to achieve that.
Follow up?
So I just want to know, since this is a confirmation hearing, then your philosophy is that even though there's a minimum of an 11% increase in producer share from 37% to 48% before subtracting the credits, that's an appropriate level to go forward with for some while and maybe consider something in the future, but you're willing to have the deficits that we're currently experiencing while pushing that tax amount or that producer share amount that high, almost to 50%.
So I think that I'm not trying to endorse that regime or not. I candidly have not looked at it carefully enough to be able to respond to that question. I think that, as you know, that is a growing share of a shrinking pie, and so I think there's I would want to engage in another level of analysis to really understand how I think about that regime. What I'm trying to signal is not necessarily an endorsement or rejection of that regime, but rather to say that I don't think this is the right time in our states. Right time in the state to revisit that, given the degree of change that the industry has experienced over the last number of years.
And thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. And I just wanted to object to the idea of a growing share of a shrinking pie, because between 2017 and 2018, we've been very happy that there's been an increase in production and there's been an increase in price. So that's not a shrinking pie at all between, the oil company's own statistics that they presented to the House Resources Committee. And so I appreciate that. Thank you.
Thank you. Brief at ease. Okay, House Finance is back on record. So with that, I would like to recommend that Commissioner Designee Sheldon Fisher's name be forwarded to a joint session of the legislature for consideration. And just a reminder that signing this conference report does not reflect intent by any member to vote for or against Commissioner Designee Fisher during any further sessions for the purposes of confirmation. So with that, if there are no objections, we'll take brief at ease to sign the report. Finance is back on record at 2:24 p.m. And the first bill up today is HB 233, which is Education Tax Credits, Sunset and Repeals by Representative Tuck. And it is my plan to have this bill introduced today and then to take invited and public testimony. So at this time, I'd like to invite Representative Tuck and his aide, Ms. Kendra Kloster, to the table. And if you could put yourselves on the record and proceed with your presentation.
Thank you, committee chairs and committee members. I'm Representative Chris Tuck, representing District 23, South Central Anchorage. Along with me is Kendra Kloster, who will be giving you a presentation on the history and the structure and the benefits of the of House Bill 233, the Education Tax Credit. So thank you for hearing us today.
For the record, Kendra Kloster, staff to Rep. Sam Tuck. We put together a brief presentation just to kind of go through the history and what the Education Tax Credit Program is, as I've received a few questions about it. So hopefully I can answer some of them ahead of time. Okay. The Education Tax Credit System was put into place in 1987. This established to encourage private businesses to start making contributions to our institutions and facilities. In 2010, the credit was increased from 50% to 100% on contributions between $101,000 to $300,000, and maximum annual credit was expanded from $150,000 up to $5 million. In 2011 and 2014, the legislature passed two other bills listing the institutions and programs that were eligible, expanding that by the various tax types, which I'll get into a little bit more later. And in 2014, House Bill 306, from the indirect expenditure report, they had put a sunset date on the Education Tax Credit Program, which is why we are here today. So the bill in front of you, House Bill 233, will extend the effective date from the repeal, which is set at December 31st, 2018. This bill will extend it to January 1, 2025. It ensures that the tax credit system that is currently in statute today will be maintained till 2025. And that's an important point to bring up because in some, as we go through, if you're looking at the bill, some of our tax credits have a rollback in 2021. So what we're doing is saying what our tax credit system looks like today, right now, everything will be expanded until 2021. Because some of the sunset dates for those previous bills that I mentioned that the legislature had passed for expanding the program, the amounts, and how many programs are available, those have an extension to 2021. So we're lining them all up so an extension date to 2025 for everything in the program. There are many different kind of opportunities. Private donations can go to a variety of educational institutions, facilities, and programs. They can be nonprofits, but they also have to have an educational purpose to receive the education tax credit. Go to elementary, secondary schools, apprenticeship programs, higher education investment fund, and our post-secondary institutions. These are non-transferable, non-refundable credits that a donor can apply against the following categories: corporate income tax, fisheries, business, and resource landing tax, insurance premium, title insurance premium tax, mining license tax, oil and gas production tax, and oil and gas property tax. All of those are listed there, and hopefully you have a copy of this presentation too. Right now, you can get 50% of the annual contributions up to $100,000 from the next block from 101 to 300,000, you can have 100% of those contributions, and then drops back down to 50%. You can get credit for the for your donations for 300,000 and above. And across all tax types, you cannot exceed $5 million for this tax credit. Why is this important, and why do we want to extend and keep this program going? The education tax credit allows and needs to be filled directly. A lot of our industries are partnering with our education systems, and I think one that I found to be very interesting is our mining program. So here at UAS, when the bill was passed in 2010 to expand or increase the amount up to $5 million of what the tax credits, we saw a big influx of funding from private investors. Hecla, the Greens Creek mine, really helped build our UAS training facility here to get people in Alaska trained in Alaska and out in our workforce here. So what we're doing is we're training Alaskans, we're keeping them here, and we're building the relationships with our private industry, and they're really building great partnerships all throughout Alaska. And I know there's some folks online that will talk more about this, but that was one program in particular that I've had at least a lot of conversations about, and when working through this bill, and the previous bill actually I worked through as well. So, and these are just some reports just to know, and we do have Ken Alper here that can probably get into more detail about this. So if you have really specific questions on the funds and how they come in and go out, I will have him as my backup. But this chart here is for summary of kind of 2015, so you can see what is coming in to our system here. We have claim credits of about $7 million, but we are actually getting more money in. So this is money that we may not have seen coming into our education system. And this will go into the calendar year 2017. So with the tax credits, a little over $6 million, however, bringing over $9 million in funding. So that is getting us additional money. And as you know, as a lot of we're talking about our budgets and things that we're having to look at, I think what we really want to see is private industry starting to do even more and coming up and really partnering with our programs to ensure that our education systems are still training all of our Alaskans here. These are actually just a few kind of examples and information that I got through the university. I won't read through all of them, but there's many examples I think that you're going to hear in public testimony of how this tax credit has been able to help our programs. And with that, I'll be available for any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Kloster. And as was mentioned, Mr. Ken Alper, Director of the Tax Division at the Department of Revenue, is also available. And just in the interest of time, just a reminder to members as we move forward with questions for the sponsor, we've got five people on my list here for invited testimony, and there are some people who will likely want to do public testimony here, and then we do have the next bill, so if we could just kind of keep an eye on the clock. Are there any questions for the sponsor, Representative Wilson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So for the donations, do they have to be made to Alaska nonprofits and Alaskan schools? And also on page 9, you have student fellowships. Do the student fellowships have to also go to Alaskans?
Representative Wilson, through the chair, I know Ken Alper can speak to this a little bit more, but they do have to go into programs that are here in Alaska and benefit Alaskans. So the private industry would give the donation to that program, educational program or university, and then they could go ahead and put it toward their tax, and they'll go through, and the state would look at that more closely. But it does have to be, you know, here within Alaska.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Do we have any further questions for the sponsor? Ortiz, Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Going back to slide 2, established to encourage private businesses to make charitable contributions to Alaska educational institutions and facilities. Does that include the ability to make contributions to private Alaska educational institutions, or do they have to be public institutions in terms of, or does it matter?
And sorry, Representative Ortiz, through the chair. One of the documents that I do want to point you towards is we have in our packet, it lists all of the different organizations that have received the tax credit, and so I think that might help explain everyone who is eligible.
And
that's from the Department of Revenue.
Yes.
I can go through that, but you can see the list of all the individuals.
Thank you. Representative Seaton.
Thank you. On page 7, under the beneficiaries, there's $2 million in other. What was that? $2,026,000. On the far right-hand column under corporate income tax.
Oh, Representative Seaton, through the chair, I see what you're looking at. I will go back and slide. So I believe here you're looking on the other column. So if you're going to look at the, I'm also going to have Ken Alper probably come up and talk to us a little bit more as this is the stuff that he's put together. But university, APU, and secondary vocational, and I think the other would be the maybe the nonprofits and things that would fit under there that have educational programs that they can get the tax credit if they have an educational purpose. And so, again, I'd like Ken Alper probably to come and speak to exactly all of the different things that fit under other.
Mr. Alper, if you could come up and put yourself on the record and take a stab at the question. Representative Seaton. Page 7.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Ken Alper. I'm the director of the Tax Division for the Department of Revenue. I'm happy to be here. What Ms. Kloster mentioned was the annual report. What's on slide number 7 for 2015, slide number 8, was the equivalent chart from the other annual report, 2017, is page 2 of a 3-year report. What we provide to the presiding officers is a cover letter, and then this table, and then the third page is the detailed list of who the recipients are. She referred to that a few minutes ago. That contains the list of the so-called other, the list of all the various nonprofits, watershed partnerships, anything that would be eligible to be getting the tax credit donations that aren't either a university or a vocational program. Those are sort of the big categories. But frankly, Mr. Chair, the education tax credit's been a fairly rich area of legislative involvement over the years. The list of eligible entities has evolved dramatically. There's a lot of sort of boutique line items in there that were added for one reason or another on top of the original university, public school, voc ed type things. And they all add up to the other. And I also want to be clear, that list, which should be in your packet, is not the donors. It's not who received the tax credit. It's the recipients who received the donations. The people who made the donation are taxpayers of some sort, whether mining companies, fishing companies, or general corporations. Though that information is confidential. We can't report who the donors and tax credit receivers are.
Mr. Chair, I don't find that in my packet.
Take a brief at ease. Record, Representative Seaton, did you have a follow-up? Okay. Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I do on the same point, and I'm sure there's a good explanation under the other. The two that stand out, Alaska Business Weekly and Granite Construction. Can you talk to me about why they're eligible?
So through the chair, Representative Guttenberg, first off, I don't know the specifics of any individual donation. I can say broadly that it doesn't necessarily mean that they're eligible. It means that a tax credit was claimed for a donation to them. Eventually, that might be audited. That might be reviewed and disallowed upon examination. There's a little bit of a delay inherent in the education tax credit because, as Ms. Kloster said, it's not a refundable tax credit. The company makes a donation, and then possibly a year later when they're filing their taxes, it's a subtraction. It's a line item reduction in the tax form. So we don't even know about it at the time the donation is made until the company pays their taxes, and then it has to go through our review process. So it's possible that they weren't. But it's quite probable that they are legitimate because they are involved in some sort of an educational mission. In the case of the construction company, I'm guessing it's a job training, some sort of an apprenticeship program. I know that the statute has language that allows for apprenticeship programs to be eligible donors. Over in the other body, Senator Bishop has taken an interest in this credit over the years and has added a number of provisions that would enable more private sector job training type entities to qualify and not just school-based job training programs.
Thank you. I just look forward to a follow-up.
Representative Tilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So of all the recipients on the list, are all of these Alaska-based? I'm just wondering about maybe the Smithsonian Institution.
Through the chair, Representative Tilton, yes, if you go to the statute language, which lists, and it's an awkward statute because it's listed in seven different places in the book inside the production tax and the mining tax and so forth, but the language more or less parallels in all of those areas. It talks about activities in Alaska. What I'm guessing, and I'm frankly guessing here, is that the Smithsonian had some sort of a research project maybe related to in the ocean or something like that off Alaska that was funded by a grant from an Alaskan company and for work done in Alaska, but the recipient was the home office of the Smithsonian in Washington.
Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So I'm looking at the statute number 4320.014, and it does specifically say eligible foundation by profit. By nonprofit, public, or private, Alaska two-year, four-year college accredited by regional credit association or by public or private nonprofit elementary secondary school. Now, in some ways, I hate to bring this up because I'm going to be visited tomorrow by my own private school, Holy Name Elementary School, that, you know, I'm certainly a supporter of. But do you remember, or is there any record of how much discussion went into that idea of allowing what would be public funds if it was collected in a normal tax situation to go to private institutions? Was there much discussion about that? Is that and do you know whether how much, what kind of money in terms of annually goes into private institutions?
So through the chair, Representative Ortiz, I think that would be in the other category because it's not the University of Alaska and it's not vocational training, so it would fit within that list. We can't, again, report the actual amount by recipient. That section you're reading is subsection 1 of the long list of them. I think that's the original language going back to the 80s. I'm not certain if it's evolved over the years to add the reference to public or private. I don't know the legislative history. There have been literally a dozen or more amendments to this over a 30-year period, but so far as I know, that's always been there. What I'll draw the committee's attention to is that the bill before you is a clean extension. It takes several things and it moves them on, and the bill's very hard to read because it's just a lot of pre-existing sections of other bills that have passed getting extended. But there's really three things happening here that are independently adjustable by the committee if you so desire. You've got a overall program that's scheduled to sunset in December of this year. That was added really as part of Representative Thompson's indirect expenditure bill a few years ago. If that happens, all bets are off on everything else. Obviously, the program is gone. You also have another provision that changed the credit rate from what amounts to 50% of the first $300,000 to what amounts to about 83% of the first $300,000. That's been on the books since 2011, and it's scheduled to go away in 2021. That is extended by this also, so the higher credit rates remain in place to the new sunset of 2025. And the third set is this list of eligible entities. There's sort of the core list of 7 or 8 of them, and then a few others that were added in 2011 and are also scheduled to come off the list in 2021. That sunset is also extended in the bill before you. So if you so desired and you wanted to engage in the eligibility side of it, that you have the ability to do so, just not in the way the bill is currently written.
And if
Ms. Kloster?
May add one thing to Mr. Ortiz, to the chair, is this is, I put up on the slide, if you look at slide 4, the selection of eligible entities, there's a list of them, so you can take a look at that as well.
Maybe if members could, if you have any questions, just write those down. I'd like to move over to our public or invited testifiers and give them an opportunity while they're available. And we will be setting this bill aside, so we'll have an opportunity to ask the sponsor additional questions. So with that, our first invited testifier online is Susan Foley, University of Alaska Foundation President. And let's see here, Ms. Foley, I believe, are you online or are you in the room here? I think you're online.
Yes, I'm on the line.
Thank you, Ms. Foley. For all of our invited testifiers, we have about 45 minutes left today. And so if we could keep your testimony to 4 or 5 minutes, that'll give us an opportunity to hear from other folks who would like to testify from the public, as well as take public testimony on the bill that we have after this. So, Ms. Foley, if you could put yourself on the record and proceed with your testimony.
Yes, and Mr. Co-Chair, I'm having a very hard time hearing you. So if you have anything you want to convey to me, if you could speak as close as possible to that microphone, it would be wonderful.
Sure. And if you could put yourself on the record, Ms. Foley.
Yes. My name is Susan Foley, and I am the president of the University of Alaska Foundation. And I want to, first of all, thank all the members of the committee for your service in general, but in particular, your service on this very important committee of the legislature. You deal with a lot of important things every day, and this is among them. The University of Alaska and the University of Alaska Foundation strongly support the bill as presented and the continuation without any narrowing in scope of the tax credits to January 1st, 2025. This is a little bit of an illogical thing, but this is actually an indirect investment in education by a redirection of funds that would otherwise be received as tax revenue. And there is a tremendous opportunity through the educational tax credit for leveraging those investments. What happens with the educational tax credit when funds come into the University of Alaska system is that contributions are made and then they are directed here at the UA Foundation. And the foundation's responsibility is to assure that those contributions are used in a way that is appropriate, legal, and beneficial. It is generally programs where there has been conversation in advance that receive these contributions. The programs, though, that receive contributions are not programs that are directed by industry or established by industry. The ripple effect from their contributions occurs when students receive their education, go out into Alaska, and take jobs that benefit our economy. With regard to research opportunities, oftentimes research that is done as a result of these contributions will lead to business opportunities beyond the scope of the donors' programs. These enable the university to be responsive and nimble in ways that are more challenging. Otherwise, the contributions are not made to every program. They're made to select programs. But as I said before, it is the university that determines curriculum. It is the university that directs how these funds will be used and assures that there is appropriate educational work happening as a result of the donations. With that, I will conclude my testimony and invite questions.
Thank you, Ms. Foley. Does the committee have any questions? Representative Seaton?
Yeah, I had one on the extension here.
Excuse me, through the chair. I'm sorry, I cannot hear you.
Thank you. Is this better?
Yes, thank you.
Looking at Section W of the proposal here on either any of these sections, there's credit for cash contribution for a facility or intercollegiate sports tournament by an Alaskan two-year or four-year college. So are you testifying that we should not, we should continue that particular tax credit for a sports tournament?
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you. Do we have any further questions for Ms. Foley? Seeing none, thank you very much, Ms. Foley, for calling in. Our next testifier, invited testifier online, is Doug Walrath, PhD Director of the Northwest Alaska Career and Technical Center. And Mr. Walrath, if you could put yourself on the record and state your affiliation and proceed with your testimony.
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the Finance Committee, thank you for this opportunity. My name is Doug Walrath. I'm the director of the Northwestern Alaska Career and Technical Center in Nome, also known as NACTEC. NACTEC is a cross-district collaborative regional training center serving Bering Strait School District and Nome Public Schools. I'll be testifying in support of House Bill 233 with a sunset extension to 2025 while otherwise maintaining the credit as it exists in statute today. Over the past 8 years, the loss of federal funding with the elimination of earmark appropriations and the constriction of state UGF has made the education tax credit increasingly important to NACTEC operations and programming. Tax credit contributions now account for one-third of our annual operating budget. Since 2009, we have actively pursued industry partnership, receiving 23 industry tax credit contributions. 13 of those contributions were in what I would call the sweet spot of this legislation, above $100,000 up to $300,000. The top four contributions we've received exceed the total of the bottom 10 contributions. And while each tax credit contribution is important for the respective training program it supports, contributions between $200,000 and $300,000 for our program increase our program efficiency as we spend less administrative time chasing funding and more time developing quality training programs. The education tax credit has been a wonderful tool for bringing industry and education partners together and has the added benefit of built-in accountability that comes from private sector investment in public education. One of the most profound impacts on our student population has been a noteworthy increase in graduation rates. Over the past 9 years, graduation rates have grown from a low of 32% in 2008, now this is prior to tax credit contributions to our program, to a high of 85% last year. This is in Bering Strait School District with a 99% Alaska Native population. So as graduation rates have climbed, obviously the dropout rate has decreased, and it's decreased by 76% over the past 3 years. A 2009 research study determined that the cost of dropping out of high school was $292,000 per dropout. Noting this and the difference that we're seeing here locally, this is a difference that you won't see on paper of anything that's been presented here, but a difference of $8.5 million annually per graduating class in Bering Strait School District alone. So in closing, I'd like to say the education tax credit is an example of well-crafted legislation in need of a sunset extension to continue benefiting vocational training and workforce development training just as it's doing in the Bering Straits region. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Walrath. Are there any questions of the committee? And I don't see any questions, so thank you for your testimony. Let's next move over to Tommy Sheridan from Silver Bay Seafoods. Mr. Sheridan, if you could put yourself on the record as well as your affiliation and proceed with your testimony.
Good afternoon. My name is Tommy Sheridan. I'm the Director of Government Affairs for Silver Bay Seafoods, and I just want to check and make sure you all can hear me.
Yes, we can hear you just fine.
Okay, thank you. Thank you for the opportunity to testify this afternoon. Silver Bay Seafoods strongly supports Alaska House Bill 233 as currently presented. For those of you unfamiliar with Silver Bay, the company began in 2007 as a single salmon processing facility in Sitka, Alaska, and has since grown into one of the largest seafood companies in the state, currently operating large-scale facilities in Sitka, Craig, Valdez, Naknek, and Metlakatla. Apart from the examples that you've been shown of relevance to the seafood processing industry, funding made possible through education tax credits has resulted in notable training opportunities for Alaskan youth. A recent example includes ATSI Processors Association and Gold Belt, Inc. funding of students in the University of Alaska Southeast Fisheries Technology Program during the 2017 through 2018 academic year. As a result of this support, over 50 Alaskan high school students were able to take university-level fisheries coursework all over the state, from Kodiak, Juneau, and Sitka to Unalaska, Galena, and Petersburg. I personally benefited from similar opportunities as a student in the Fisheries Technology Program. With financial assistance made possible by donations from Icicle Seafoods, I completed an undergraduate certificate in fisheries technology before going on to complete several graduate-level programs at Oregon State University, including a graduate certificate in fisheries management and a master's of science in fisheries and wildlife administration. Education tax credits have also been used to support applied fisheries research and the management of Alaskan fishery resources dependent upon such research. For example, Silver Bay has contributed approximately $100,000 to the Bristol Bay Fisheries Collaborative, or BBFC, which is a grassroots initiative developed in 2016 by stakeholders to help stem the erosion of financial support for Bristol Bay's salmon fishery management. According to the BBFC 2017 annual report, more than $685,000 was pledged to this program to fund salmon monitoring projects for the 2017 season alone. The report claims that this resulted in fish stocks being better utilized and that important long-term data sets were maintained, all in a more coordinated manner than would have otherwise been possible. In summary, extension of the Education Tax Credit Program through HB 233 will continue to promote private investment in Alaskan higher education and will also ensure that Alaska is able to maintain its world-class fishery management system. Silver Bay Seafoods is supportive of these efforts, and thanks you for your consideration of this important legislation.
Thank you, Mr. Sheridan. Does the committee have any questions? I don't see any questions. Thank you for calling in. Our next invited testifier online is Karen Mathis, Executive Director of the Council of Alaska Producers. And if you could also put your name and your affiliation on the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Karen Mathias, and I'm the Executive Director of the Council of Alaska Producers. CAP is a nonprofit trade association formed in 1992 to represent the interests of the large metal mines and mine development projects in Alaska. Thank you for this opportunity to speak in support of HB 233 as presented. The education tax credit has a long, successful track record doing exactly what it was intended to do. It was established back in 1987 to encourage private businesses to make donations to support education in Alaska. CAP's members have welcomed the opportunity to partner with the state of Alaska and provide funding directly to education and training. In the previous 7 years, mining companies in Alaska used the education tax credit to invest a total of almost $20 million in programs like mining engineering at UAS, geology at UAA, direct contributions to the Northwest Arctic School District, and also vocational and technical options like the mining and petroleum training services, which is provided by the UAF Cooperative Extension Services, which has facilities in Anchorage, Soldotna, and Juneau, and also the UAF Pathways to Mining, which was mentioned earlier. It's important to note, as was mentioned by the UAF testifier, that the donations have no strings attached. They don't give companies influence over the curriculum or staff decisions or who gets into the course. CAP members support education because they want to see strong communities and a skilled workforce. It makes it much easier to hire locally and to retain skilled employees. The two programs I just mentioned, the Mining and Petroleum Training Services and U.S. Pathways to Mining, educate and perhaps most importantly provide hands-on training that can lead directly to the jobs in the industry. And this couldn't come at a more critical time because the mining industry, like many in Alaska, is aging. So now is the time to support programs that give young Alaskans the chance to learn job skills for mining and other industries. These industries are the foundation of Alaska's economy, and their growth can be part of the solution to Alaska's fiscal challenges. Opening the bill up for changes now could really slow it down, and if it doesn't get passed this year, the program will go away for the mining education tax credit. I urge you to pass a clean extension bill to renew this program and keep it working the way it should. Thank you.
And thank you, Ms. Mathias. Are there any questions of the committee? And I don't see any, so thank you also for calling in. And lastly, we have online Brad Moran, Dean of the College of Fisheries and Ocean Science at UAF. Ms. Moran, if you could also put your name and your affiliation on the record and proceed.
Yes, thank you. This is Brad Moran. As it noted, the Dean of the College of Fisheries and Ocean Science, University of Alaska Fairbanks. Thank you for this opportunity to provide testimony to HB 233. I'd like to note that our college has utilized the education tax credit now for nearly 20 years, and it has greatly benefited from the ETC with over $25 million support in research, scholarship, fellowships, and outreach funding. I would like to say up front that thank you very much to Senator Coghill, to Representative Tuck, and others who have worked to continue this program for the benefit of the university and for the state of Alaska. I'd like to just point to one example that we rely on in our college heavily to support students and their research and education for the benefit of the state is the Pollock Conservation Cooperative Research Center, the PCCRC. That is an organization that is supported by ATSI processors, fishers, based in Seattle, in the state of Washington, who provided now through the end of 2017, using the education tax credit, roughly $20 million into marine research and education at our college, and in fact is the largest single contributor to marine research at the University of Alaska. So that is actually support coming to the state of Alaska from corporations based outside of the state of Alaska, facilitated through the education tax credit. Thank you very much for the time, for opportunity, I should say, to provide this public testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Moran. We do have a question from Representative Guerra.
Thank you. Mr. Moran, is your school a nonprofit? I didn't hear exactly what the school was. I'm sorry.
Yeah, it's part of the University of Alaska Fairbanks. It is the College of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences.
And through the chair.
The State University of University of Alaska Fairbanks.
So are you able to accept, so are contributions to the university treated as nonprofit contributions?
They go through, you heard from testimony from Susan Foley, they go through the university foundation.
I guess the question then is, I just want to make sure we're spending our money wisely. A company would get a federal tax deduction for donating. How can you assure me that the same amount of money wouldn't come in even without the smaller state tax credit? The federal tax credit is larger, right? Or the federal tax deduction?
I honestly am not an expert in the tax laws. All I can really provide is that through this ETC, this particular center, this research center, allows for these corporations to invest in our college and leverage actually the state and federal investments that are being made in fisheries particularly. As far as, you know, the intricacies of those tax policies, I honestly can't answer that accurately.
All right, thanks.
Representative Thompson?
Thank you. Mr. Moran, I think you might have answered it with that last answer you had. These donations you receive, do you have any idea how much federal grant money that they leverage?
Yes. I'll use FY17 numbers. Our college is bringing in roughly $43 million in primarily federal research dollars. A big portion of that is the operation of the research vessel Sikuliak that we operate here.
Representative Thompson?
So is that a 50-50 type match, or is there more leverage from that?
No, it's not a 50-50 match. I mean, we roughly have $40 million, give or take, in federal research expenditures, whereas $20 million has been brought into the college, give or take, since year 2000.
Okay, thank you very much.
Do you have any further questions? I don't see any further questions. Thank you for calling in, Mr. Moran. And so that concludes our invited testimony. So at this time, I will open up public testimony on HB 233. And also, for anybody who might be watching on TV, if you would like to submit written testimony, you can do so by submitting that to an email to House Finance, no spaces, houseFinance@akleg.gov. And so with that, is there anybody here in the room who would like to testify? And I don't see anybody online. Greta Shirk, are you there?
Hi, good afternoon. Can you hear me?
Yes, Greta, we can hear you just fine. And if you could put your name and your affiliation on the record and proceed.
Wonderful, you bet. Good afternoon, Co-Chair Foster, Co-Chair Seaton, members of the committee. This is, for the record, this is Greta Shirk. I'm Senior Government Relations Coordinator at Tech Alaska, Red Dog Mine. And I'm calling today on behalf of both Tech and Nana Regional Corporation in support of the reauthorization of the Alaska Education Tax Credit Program included in House Bill 233. Many of you know Red Dog is situated in the Northwest Arctic Borough. It was developed in partnership between Nana and Tech, in which Nana owns the mineral resource and Tech operates the mine. Multiple Nana subsidiaries provide support services to the mine operations, providing even more jobs to Nana shareholders and other Alaskans. And when Red Dog was developed, a critical priority was to deliver employment, training, and education opportunities to Nana shareholders, and that remains a critical priority today. Nana and Tech work together to strive for a 100% shareholder workforce at the mine by providing college scholarships, on-the-job training, and generous opportunities for other training and development. And today, we currently operate at 58% shareholder hire up at the mine site. Through the Alaska Education Tax Credit Program, Red Dog have the ability to also contribute to increasing the number of shareholders who receive training at the Alaska Technical Center and the start of the Northwest Magnet School in Kotzebue, where mineral development and other technical trades are developed and offered. Red Dog contributions have also supported student counseling programs and programs that develop general job readiness skills, and both Tech and Nana benefit from the programs offered at ATC because the curriculum helps develop a workforce of qualified shareholders who later become trained millwright operators, drillers, and welders. ATC also offers programs in skill development and process technology, culinary arts, nursing, and education, all of which are widely transferable skills across multiple industries in the state. Red Dog also contributes to UAA's Institute of Social and Economic Research and have provided funding to UAF's mining engineering facility to also develop engineering professions. The Education Tax Credit Program creates the opportunity for industries to work in partnership with local school districts and state institutions to develop programs and shape career opportunities for students. By creating these partnerships with ATC and the University of Alaska, companies like Tech and Nana are able to promote workforce development and educational programs, both secondary and post-secondary, which lead to hiring of local Alaskans. It's often said that Red Dog is a community that happens to have a major industry within it. Every community must produce and provide many diverse services that require a diverse workforce to support the people who live in that community. Targeted educational support utilizing this tax credit program helps achieve a job-ready and diverse workforce, which of course in turn contributes to the livelihoods of people in communities throughout Alaska. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Shirk. We have a question from Representative Wilson.
Thank you. Thank you for what you do. Do you have any idea how many Alaskans, just, you know, a ballpark number, are able to get educational assistance, whether it's at the mine or at the schools, because of this credit that you're able to use?
Representative Wilson, through the chair, I don't have a number for you at the moment. I mean, the Northwest Arctic Borough, its population is upwards of 7,000 people in the 11 communities there. So I'm trying to think of a number of students that are able to utilize this directly and indirectly. Happy to research that and get some more concrete numbers back to you.
I'd appreciate it. Thank you.
You bet.
We have any further questions for Ms. Shirk? Seeing none, thank you for calling in. Is there anybody else online who would like to testify? And anybody else in the room? Seeing none, we will close public testimony on HB 233. And thank you to folks who have called in. And so with that, we will set the bill aside. And amendments, if folks would like to submit amendments, if they could submit those to Jane Pearson in my office by 5 p.m. on Thursday, March 29th, be appreciated. And so with that, looks like we've got just over 20 minutes left here, and we do have another bill up before us. So that is HB 303, Workers' Compensation, Rehabilitation, and Reemployment. It's rules by request of the governor, and here to present the bill is Heidi Dragas, Commissioner of the Department of Labor and Workforce Development, and Marie Marks, Director of Workers' Compensation. We do have a committee substitute before us, so before we begin the presentation on the bill, I would like to get the CS introduced as the committee's working draft, and so if either of you could walk the committee through the changes through the CS, and let's see, we also have public testimony, and let me see if we've got... It looks like we have three people at the Anchorage LIO, so hopefully we could adopt the CS, get the introduction to, and the changes, adopt the CS, hear the public testimony. We will also be setting this bill aside, and so we can ask questions today and also at our at another meeting. Representative Wilson?
So do you want to move the CS before us first?
Maybe if we could get
the changes,
if the committee is okay with that, if there's no objection, Representative Wilson.
I'd like to move 30GH2709/D before us as a working document.
I'm sorry, Representative Wilson. Did you say backslash D or
D?
J.
J. I said J.
Okay.
I'll say it again. I'd like to move 30GH2709J. Sorry, I had them both in front of me as a working document.
Thank you, Representative Wilson. Are there any objections to adopting the CS? Seeing none, the CS for HB 303, version 30-GH2709/J for Juliet is before the committee as its working draft. And I believe, Ms. Marks, are you walking the committee through the changes?
Yes, for the record, Marie Marks, Director of the Division of Workers' Compensation. And Chair Foster, the changes will be very simple. There's just one, which is page 11. It just inserts language, and this was to address an issue that was brought up in a previous committee. It inserts language stating that the one-year time limit on pre-planned benefits, and this may be not make sense to you quite yet, but it will after I think go through it. But there was there's a one-year time limit on benefits paid before parties in retraining agree to a retraining plan. This clarifies that that one-year limit does not apply during a time when there's an appeal process in place or things are on hold while a decision's being made. And that's so if the injured worker is found to have prevailed, they will be able to get that retroactive benefit paid to them.
Thank you. And before we move to the presentation, are there any questions on what Ms. Marks just said? Seeing none, Ms. Marks, if you could... go ahead and move into your presentation, and if maybe just if you could state your name for the record, since we have two female voices prior to speaking. And with that, please begin.
For the record, I'll put myself on the record. For the record, this is Heidi Dragas. I'm the Commissioner for the Department of Labor and Workforce Development. Thank you for hearing our bill today. I'll turn it right over to Director Marks.
Great. So I know that the committee has seen these slides before, so I won't spend too much time on them, but I do like to start with a refresher of what is workers' compensation. Just a reminder, it's a system of insurance that protects workers and employers from some of the losses caused by on-the-job accidents and illnesses. It all is part of the grand bargain. Employer provides prompt, necessary medical and wage loss benefits to injured workers for a work injury. In exchange, the injured worker receives limited benefits. And the administration is guided by these five pillars in administering the Alaska Workers' Compensation Act. The benefits provided are medical care, wage loss benefits, death benefits in the event of a work-related death, and retraining benefits. And all we are talking about here today above HB 303 is the retraining benefits portion. Retraining or reemployment benefits, they're benefits that are intended to return an injured worker to work when the worker cannot return to their job that they were injured at or any jobs which they have relevant training or experience. And I'm going to kind of flip to a back slide. I'm not going to go through this, but the red highlighted boxes just show you the small portion that we're dealing with for HB 303. We are not talking about instances where an injured worker is injured and they can go back to work and get medical care. We're not talking about where they're off work for less than 90 days and get wage loss benefits and medical care and can return to work. The retraining benefits have to do with situations where an injured worker has been off work at least 90 consecutive days and a doctor opines they cannot return to their job of injury or any relevant jobs. The bill addresses challenges, and this started back in 2012, I think, is where the former director had conducted listening sessions and took input from the public on, you know, what needs to be done with the workers' compensation system. And working on the reemployment retraining system was one of those comments that had gotten back. And the Workers' Compensation Board, it signed a resolution in 2013, and they did one again in 2017 that said, we need to have some changes, and here's some changes that we need to do. And that was signed by members of labor and industry. And here's some challenges. The challenges we have now are that reemployment eligibility evaluations are mandatory, whether an injured worker wants to go through it or not at 90 days. They're mandatory even if the injured worker has returned to work on the 91st day. They must go through the retraining rehabilitation evaluation system. Even if they're not medically stable and the doctor doesn't quite know whether they will be able to return to work or not, again, at 90 days, they are really forced to go through that system. The maximum plan cost is $13,300 that has not been adjusted since the year 2000, and this is often insufficient to develop a plan. The plans currently focus on the quickest return to work option, regardless of the worker, if the worker has an interest in that vocational goal. There is a declining pool of rehabilitation specialists. This results in delays in some areas, especially in central Alaska. And the lack of a fee schedule for rehabilitation specialists limits the cost effectiveness and the quality of the services. HB 303 addresses these challenges. It improves the delivery of reemployment benefits to injured workers. It provides eligible employees with more choices in reemployment goals and plans. And it encourages injured employees' early return to work and helps employers control costs. There is a quick reference guide as part of the documents there called a summary of key provisions that outlines more details about how HB 303 accomplishes this. And I'd be happy to go through that, or I could also go through the sectional analysis, I guess, depending on the will of the committee. Sure. Chair Seaton. And the last. Sure.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So you were in my office, and I appreciated that the briefing, and we went through these numbers.
Sure.
And can you talk about the workers that are getting reemployment benefits or who haven't been considered unemployable or have been considered unemployable? Right, they are hurt on the job, and before they're considered eligible for benefits, they're paid off, or even after the fact. That was something I had not understood.
Through the chair, Representative Guttenberg, that is correct. One of the provisions in the bill would no longer permit an injured worker to settle reemployment benefits with their employer. And these next two slides show statistics about why that policy call was made. In fiscal year 2017, 564 injured workers were referred for an eligibility evaluation, and 148 injured workers were determined eligible. 14 completed retraining plans. And those numbers have been fairly consistent through the years. A handful of injured workers actually complete retraining plans. Why is this? The next slide shows you in fiscal year 17, there was 164 injured workers who settled reemployment benefits. You'll notice this number is greater than those actually found eligible. Why is that? Because there are a significant number of workers who settle reemployment benefits before being found eligible or even after being found ineligible. And of course, all this is accounted for in the costs of reemployment benefits. And so that's why on paper, the reemployment benefit system looks like a very expensive system for what on paper looks like very little results, return, correct. And so through the chair, Representative Guttenberg, that is you were asking about those numbers. I think that's kind of why that policy call was made. And at the very beginning, the administration took a step back, and I probably have the commissioner answer this and says, what are we trying to do? What do we want to do with a retraining program? And the answer was, we want to return injured workers to work. That's the goal. How do we do that? A key piece is saying you select retraining benefits, or you can take what exists now, which is a small job dislocation benefit. That exists now, and we're upping that amount a little bit, but those are your options. And no longer have a direct check to the injured worker of payment and a lump sum to the injured worker for retraining. Now, an injured worker can settle medical costs, they can settle temporary wages, anything other than retraining benefits. And I do want to emphasize that employers can always agree with injured worker to pay more through our system, and it happens now. Right now, the benefit is $13,300, and just recently, I talked to our reemployment benefit administrator, and she runs the program, and she says it often happens, and recently, the parties agreed to pay $20,000 in our program. They agreed. They wanted the injured worker to succeed, and they came up with a plan, and it was more than $13,300, but by agreement, they paid more. The difference is it's through the system. It's accountability through the system. The checks are not going to the injured worker. The checks, for example, will be going to the college or the certification program. So I do want to emphasize that the parties can still agree to pay more for work comp benefits, workers' compensation benefits. It's just the HB 303 requires the accountability through our system and it be done through the system. And that's all the summary key provisions, I think, outlines the major changes. And that's the last slides were just statistics, and that's really all we had. Unless
thank you. We've got Representative Guttenberg, and then Representative Wilson, and Representative Kawasaki.
Mr. Chair, thank you. So the change is the reinsurance benefit, $13,000 or $18,000, instead of going to the individual, goes through the department now, through the program. Is, let's say somebody's already in school, decided to go in school, are they eligible for reimbursement? And what, I mean, because they've already incurred expenses, or I know a lot of the controversy here is people have been out of work for a long time and they have mortgage to pay, or they have child care, or they have things that allow them to function on a day-to-day basis. That's part of the accountability question, but the situation is the person takes the benefit and doesn't use it for the benefit's purpose, and that's kind of that's part of the scenario we're looking at. Am I correct?
Through the chair, Representative Guttenberg, that is correct. The injured worker would no longer get a direct lump sum check issued to them, which may be then used for mortgage payments or so forth. Any money for retraining would be accountable for and be paid for retraining benefits and some accountability there.
And if I may follow through.
Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you. So we had this conversation. So theoretically, somebody's supposed to retrain for an entry-level job at 60% of what they were making before. And there's no programs that do that, right? You're a skilled worker doing something and you hurt your back and you're making $100,000 a year. There's no entry level that pays you $60,000. And you're agreeing for the settlement because there's no place that they can go to get that. But where, in the end, where are they going to go to be made to be brought back into the workforce at some significant level. I mean, I know we had this conversation, but I'm still trying to square it up in my mind.
Yes. Through the chair, Representative Guttenberg, in the summary of key provisions, you're right, that is one of them, including it raises the amounts for inflation. And one of the things it does is it allows an injured worker in some circumstances to select an occupational goal that might result in wages lower than what the law usually allows. And an example of this is someone, a worker who's on the North Slope that with overtime and compensation earns $100 per hour. What the law currently requires, and we're not changing this, is they have to be retrained in a new job, entry level, 60% of what they're earning. So the entry level job would be $60 per hour. As you can imagine, that's very difficult to do. Currently, if you can't reach that under the law, there is no retraining benefits available to you. It's just you don't get anything under the law. You can't force the employer to pay for a plan that's outside the statutory limits. What the bill does, it says an injured worker can voluntarily, if they want to, agree to be retrained at 50% or an entry-level job of 40% if they want to. It allows more plans available for retraining.
Well, just follow through on that. But the lump sum payment has to go towards the retraining, nothing else, because you're going to have accountability through the department.
Through the chair, Representative Guttenberg, there is no longer allowed a large lump sum training, lump sum amount paid out. More can be paid than the statutory maximums of $19,300, which is proposed by the bill. You can pay more than $19,300. But it would have to be through the reemployment system, and it wouldn't be paid directly to the injured worker in a big lump sum.
Thank you, Representative Guttenberg. We can continue past our time. I just want to give folks who have called in an opportunity to testify. I don't know if they have other obligations. We were scheduled from 1:30 to 3:30, and so I would like to open up a public testimony, and then we'll come back to the questions here. So we will go ahead and open up public testimony on HB 303, and if folks would like to also submit written testimony, they can do so by sending us an email to housefinance@akleg.gov. Again, housefinance@akleg.gov. And so with that, Kayla Cade, are you there calling in from Anchorage?
Hello?
Yes, we can hear you just fine. If you could put your name and your affiliation on the record and proceed with your three-minute testimony.
Yeah, hi. My name is Kaya Cade. I'm a vocational rehabilitation specialist. I've been doing reemployment benefit plans for over 20 years. I'm an Arctic blonde who remembers when it used to be a voluntary process. And so some of the regulations that are coming forth, I don't agree with. I don't agree with it being voluntary. I don't agree with the process of having the workers' comp office doing a once-a-month meeting to tell injured workers what their rights are. You could see how difficult it is just to understand it all right now. You've had some briefing, it sounds like, on your own. If you can imagine being an injured worker with a third to seventh grade reading level, that's my average, trying to understand this in a meeting with 30 other injured workers, it would be very difficult. So I would like to keep it as a referral. It doesn't need to be 90 days. I think 90 days is too short. Something around 6 months
Ms. Cade,
would be appropriate.
Ms. Cade, I'm sorry. If you could maybe speak a little closer to your microphone, it's just a little hard to hear you.
You want me to speak closer?
Yes. Thank you.
Okay. The other issue is this idea of being able to settle a plan. Settling a plan is really important. I have two people here who are going to tell you why it's important. And a third person who was going to come, but he's sick. He's given me permission to tell his story. He was first injured and was sent for what's called an independent medical evaluation. The independent medical evaluation said the injury was not happening at work. It took going to what's called a secondary independent medical evaluation, where they flew him to Hawaii to meet with a doctor who was said that it definitely happened at work, and that because he had to wear a walking boot for 9 months longer, he was further injured. He finally got his reemployment benefits. He set up a plan with me, and then he settled with the insurance company because the insurance company and him had a very poor relationship, and it wasn't good for him to be taking money every month to support himself. He's gone on. He's finished his plan, and he's been working for the past year and a half in the plan that was done for him. He is not one of the 14 that's in your numbers, nor are the other people that are here to speak to you today. The numbers need to be gathered in a way that is accurate and reflects the actual success of what's been happening in the employment benefit plan. And the last thing is that I'm not sure why they're getting involved in setting our fee schedule. I'm a licensed professional counselor with the state of Alaska. I have a master's degree. I hold two certifications. And the licensed professional counselor board doesn't set my fees. I think it would be a very complex situation to set my fees. And I think the other thing is that it's supposed to be an administrative office, and they're wanting to start doing this return to work, which is what we do. The folk rehabs work very hard. We work very hard to get people back to work as quickly as possible, and we build relationships with our employers in the town. So thank you for listening to me. I do really appreciate that they're going to up the price to $19,300. That's going to seem like a lot of money to work with after working for $13,000, which seemed a lot after $10,000. And I hope that I can answer any questions for you or some of the other people can. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Cade. Do we have any questions from the Finance Committee? I don't see any questions. Thank you for calling in, Ms. Cade. Next up, we have two more people. Debbie Evan from Anchorage, if you're there, if you could state your name and your affiliation and proceed with your three-minute testimony.
Hi, my name is Debbie Evan, and I'm a recipient of a workman's comp benefit package.
Okay, and please proceed.
Okay, so I'm opposed to the provision to not allow injured workers to settle their reemployment benefits. I did settle my reemployment benefits. I'm currently completing my education plan in a way that most benefits me and allows me to work at a manageable pace. I'm able to take the classes I need when they're offered instead of filling my schedule with classes to meet the requirements of a plan set up by Workman's Comp and not my education goals. I'm not represented in the numbers. I've settled, and I am completing my re-education. I would like to see the option to settle remain in place for people like me who need flexibility to complete training for a new job. That's it.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Evan. We have a question from Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So just so I understand, so are you getting like a set amount of money so you can continue, you know, what you need to where you live, plus then getting help with your schooling?
I decided to settle my re-education because the plan the workman's comp set out for me wasn't going to work. I was going to have to finish my plan in 16 months, which would have required me to take summer school and more credits than I could handle at the time due to my injury. So I did just receive a lump sum.
Perfect. Thank you.
Thank you. Do we have any further questions? I don't see any. Thank you for calling in. And lastly, we have Cynthia Bradley calling in from Anchorage. Ms. Bradley, if you could put yourself on the record, your name, your affiliation, and proceed with your testimony.
Okay. I think I heard what you said. It was really hard. My name is Cynthia Bradley, and I was a workman's compensation recipient. I was injured on the job at the end of 2011, and I ultimately settled my claim, and I totally I respectfully disagree with the lady there that 14 people out of the individual people that have received claims or have been on workman's compensation have not went on to do their package that was set out for them. I did receive a lump sum settlement, which I think was beneficial to me because, like she said, a lot of workers, say you make $100,000 a year and you get injured on the job, it takes an awful lot education-wise to meet that remunerative $60,000 even here in Alaska. I went from making almost $50 an hour at the job that I was working when I got injured to making $18 an hour. And that was after completing what I set for myself, what my rehabilitation specialist and myself set out for me. $18 an hour. When I started working at the job that I got injured at, I was making more than $18 an hour. And that was when I was 23. So imagine 20 years later, you having to go back and work at a job where you make $18 an hour. And it was because there was not enough funds provided for me to have a plan written for me to meet remunerative. So you're basically telling people it was a catch-22 for me. It was either take this deal or give up, you know, the livelihood that you're accustomed to. Fortunately for me, the job that I worked in, I was able to retire. So I was able to have my retirement benefit and actually take the compensation and then go out on my own, do what I had set out to do, and get reemployed. I did do, I'm a CAD drafter. I've been a CAD drafter for the past 3.5 years, but it was a little humbling to go from making a nice wage to having to take $18 an hour. This workman's compensation settlement did not in any way benefit me financially. It helped me succeed with the goal of getting another job, but not in any way reimbursing me for the damage that was done to me as a result of the accident that I was in. So I don't think that her facts are straight when she says that only 14 people went through the program. I think she needs to make contact with the people that opted to take a settlement and see what they're doing.
Thank you, Ms. Bradley. Are there any questions from the committee? I don't see any questions. Thank you for coming into the LIO to all three of you there. I see we do have one person on the off-net here, Gretchen Cusack from the Alaska Integrated Care Actions in Eagle River. If you're there, if you could put yourself on the record and proceed with your three-minute testimony.
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you just fine.
Hi, thank you for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Gretchen Cusack. I'm a certified disability management specialist, and I am with Alaska Integrated Care Options in Eagle River, Alaska. And I called in today in response to reading House Bill 303 because there are many misconceptions and there's a lot of speculation filling in blanks. And I have experience in disability management since 1993. And I've been working with injured employees in Alaska since 2015. But I'm well-versed in this field. And I'd like to say that some changes are very good. In fact, being able to have meetings with the RBA, increasing the time to 90 days for an eligibility evaluation, and Section 5, increasing the change from 30 to 60 days to complete that evaluation, is a good thing. Making sure other jobs for the employee meet remunerative pay in Section 6, that's good. A 60-day progress report on Section 9, is strengthens the plan development. I'm pleased to see the cost increase in Section 12 and also in Section 17 with the job dislocation amount, and also allowing suspension for unusual and extenuating circumstances. These do happen in life. However, I would love to say that I oppose some of the proposals in HB 303, specifically in Section 1. There is already currently qualifications determined for rehabilitation specialists, and I haven't seen any kind of arguments about why those qualifications that are currently there are not adequate. One issue that Governor Walker brought out was that there are declining numbers of rehabilitation specialists, and if you are setting fees on those remaining rehabilitation specialists, that's a sure way to make the numbers decrease further. I think it would be good to recruit, retain, and also train rehabilitation specialists. I, for one, am willing to train any injured employee with a 4-year health degree. In 2,000 hours, I can make them a certified disability management specialist. So we have capacity in Alaska to increase those numbers, and market forces will reduce the cost of what it takes to complete plans and eligibility evaluations. Setting fees will also drive down the quality. If there's a set fee for a plan and a plan needs to be modified, rehabilitation specialists are likely not to want to do that. Secondly, in Section 3, I echo prior testimony that questions the 8% return to work or completing plan, only 8%. That is a good example of misinformation. The problem is in Section 3 is that the data that should be collected by statute, I have not seen any evidence that that data has been collected. No one has been able to tell me, as a statement of fact, those who settle with a compromise and release, what is their final outcome? It's one thing to return to work. It's another thing to return to work safely and to stay at work. That's what we really want to measure, because that is what happened with an injury. The person could not stay at work. All outcomes need to be measured. That is provided for in the current statute. And HB 303 proposes to eliminate all that data except cost. That's the way I read it, is it looks like only cost on rehabilitation benefits and plans will be tracked.
Sorry,
and that is only one outcome measure. It's important, but that is only one outcome measure.
And if you could please wrap up, Ms. Cusack.
Oh, okay. The other item in Section 3, number 8, that you want to pay for a new position in terms of a return-to-work program, please be aware you already have 16 rehabilitation specialists in the state that do that. There's no way that one person in the state can replace the work of those 16 rehabilitation specialists. And you're also shifting costs from the employer to the state. When an employer is accountable for safety, drug monitoring, occupational health, disability, and case management programs, those are funded by the employer. Do not shift them to the state, please. I also don't want to eliminate compromise and release. As many have said, and I can witness to that, many employees have settled and have carried out their plans and have returned to work, and that only needs to be measured to know that.
Ms. Cusack?
So in summary, I would just say that Alaska is a unique state. These are hard times in the recession. We have an older demographic trend, and that makes for more complicated rehabilitation. We already have return-to-work programs. Don't shift that to the state. And I thank you for the opportunity to testify today. be happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Cusack. And I'm sorry, I realize you may have more, and feel free to also email your testimony to us at housefinance@akleg.gov. We have a question from Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for your testimony. And could you tell me just approximately how much does it take to, does it cost on average for a worker to have a plan made up and to follow them through to succession, you know, till they're successful?
The average plan would be, that would be very misleading because we have a huge continuum of both workers. We have a varied workforce. We have very complex injuries, both not only physical but cognitive, and also a lot of mental health involved. And plans often need to be modified. So plans can go anywhere from maybe $3,000, but they could go up towards $20,000, you know, and plans can go for a long time because a person needs to be medically stable. They could also have a re-injury, a relapse. They're very, very complicated. And I think I would respectfully ask the committee to understand the complexity and the skills and talents of a certified rehabilitation counselor or a disability management specialist to individualize what that person needs, get that person back to work as soon as possible, but in a safe and appropriate manner so that they can stay at work, and that would reduce re-injury claims.
Thank you very much.
And do we have any further questions of the committee?
To the department?
Commissioner or Ms. Marks?
Whoever wants to answer, if I may, Mr. Chair. So it's on the comments of the woman that was just online. Are all rehabilitation specialists the same? I mean, if you, there's a lot of, seems like there's a lot of things built into a person doing these plans. And what is, when you're talking about setting fees, and you're also talking about bringing them in to do consultation with the department to determine all the things that go forward, is there, well, we just heard there's a rehabilitation counselor and a rehabilitation specialist, and the difference between a master's undergraduate degree and maybe somebody with a PhD, how are you planning on setting the rates? Is it by plan? Is it by qualification? Or how do you see that going?
For the record, Heidi Dragas, Commissioner for the Department. Through the Chair, Representative Guttenberg, are all re-employment rehabilitation specialists the same? Yes and no. They're required to have master's degrees. Their requirements for developing a plan for an employee are essentially the same. Does the department get a different quality of reports from different specialists? Absolutely. There are some plans that seem very efficient, that seem well-reasoned, well thought out, and come at a lower cost than other plans that are, in my opinion, exorbitant. And it's a significant problem. We have very few rehabilitation specialists, and it's something that was important for me to incorporate into the bill. It's similar to what we're doing with workers' compensation benefits with the Medical Services Review Committee, trying to initiate a fee schedule to bring costs into alignment with plans, bring costs under control, but still making sure that we compensate re-employment specialists fairly. And I'll have Director Marks back clean up.
Ms. Marks?
Sure. Through the Chair, Representative Guttenberg, and one for the record, Marie Marks, Workers' Compensation Division. And one of the things that I think the system struggles with is that they're a specialist who does a plan and comes up with a plan that does not meet statutory requirements. absolutely flat out does not meet it. No way would it ever be approved. That bill gets paid and must be paid, the same as someone who works to come up with a plan within the statutory requirements. The specialist who has to redo a report four, five, six times gets a bill, submits a bill for that every single time, and that bill must be paid. There's no limit on that bill. Versus a specialist who submits it once or maybe has a small correction, quickly makes the correction to fix something small and submits it. Ultimately, both will reach plans, and both will reach plans that are within statutory requirements, unless, of course, the parties agree otherwise, which they still can. But both those bills have to be paid, and there's no way to figure out where that line should be. And frankly, there's the more times that things are fixed and redone, the more times that a bill is submitted.
Representative Guttenberg?
So I can understand that. So somebody does a plan. One person does a complete plan. Maybe it needs a slight modification. They get paid for that one fee. Somebody else has to do it four, five, six times. They get that much more money or a proportionate more money because they keep having to go back. Is that how they get paid?
Through the chair, Representative Guttenberg, that is correct. It's not a proportionate amount of money. It's an actual bill, an actual amount of money.
And do we have any further questions of Ms. Cusack? I don't see any questions. Thank you very much for calling in. We do have one other person who has called in, and that is Greg Weaver from Kinnick. Mr. Weaver, if you're there, if you could put your name and your affiliation on the record and proceed with your three-minute testimony.
Yes, sir. Calling as an injured worker myself, lifelong Alaskan. My name is Greg Weaver, calling from the Settlers Bay Kinnick area. I appreciate you ladies and gentlemen taking up this topic. As an injured worker myself, I was working up in Kaktovik in the northeastern corner of the state back in summer of 13 with my partner and got to a point where I couldn't walk too well. I came home and saw a DO, a doctor of osteopathy, who adjusted me a few times and told me half of my pelvis was rotated, and that was causing me to walk abnormally well. Soon after that, a workers' comp claim was started. And I was assigned a nurse case manager. I don't want to regale you with the entire miserable story, but I feel that this bill is somewhat putting the cart before the horse. There's a huge black hole in workers' comp that nobody in this state seems to want to talk about, but it's literally putting people on the street. After a worker is injured, they are often assigned an adjuster from the insurance company. I myself was working for one of the largest corporations in the state in Kaktovik at an Air Force radar site. I came home and was assigned not only this nurse case manager, but she then assigned me, she assigned me a nurse case manager. She was the senior adjuster. Anyways, the nurse case manager made an appointment, basically aggressively bullied my doctor into writing a referral to her doctor, and that was a turning point in my case. What I'm getting at is a lot of men and women have been hurt in this state, and they've been controverted because large companies can afford to fly these quote-unquote IME doctors up here from out of state. It's a known fact that these people make a huge portion of their income testifying against working people who have been hurt on the job and testifying for insurance companies, and that's exactly what happened to me. I was controverted from workers' comp. Came home with this injury from lost $100,000+ a year job, came home to a mortgage and thousands of dollars in credit card bills I couldn't pay. And before I knew it, one of this corporation's IME doctors had said that I was good to go, ready to go back to work. And that was all it took for workers' comp, the state organization, to allow this corporation to controvert me or kick me off workers' comp. All right. I'm trying to keep this brief. What I'm getting at is a lot of people, if they're even fortunate enough to get to the point of talking about reemployment benefits, by the time that happens, there so many times I know for a fact they've been kicked off workers' comp, often due to what an IME doctor says in his opinion, and they have racked up thousands and thousands of dollars in bills and mortgage and medical expenses and vehicles. Life's just everyday life, and And that's what I'm saying by putting the cart in front of the horse, is that I think that black hole needs to be looked at before too many people spend a whole lot of time fixing a problem after a pothole, because that's what's going on. It's a huge pothole. I've had two heart attacks since injury, one several months before and one the day after my spinal fusion. Fortunately, as a disabled active duty Marine Corps veteran, I had the VA to back me up after my company and the state let me down. The VA paid one of the best neurosurgeons in the state to fuse three of my lower vertebrae. Approximately 5 months ago, I've gotten off all the oxycodones and morphines and muscle relaxers and opiates that I've been on for over 3.5 years. And then several months ago, I get a decision where workers' comp denied my case, yet nowhere in that 20-plus page document do they have the courtesy or wherewithal to mention anything about my spinal fusion or the fact that I'm off drugs and hopefully going to be able to live some sort of a normal life. Unfortunately, I think I'm an example of someone who even has more complicated issues that prevent retraining because of the heart attacks and because of what I've had to deal with since this accident. I just want to thank you, Representative Wilson and Guttenberg, for asking questions. Thank you, Mr. Igas and Marks, for being there. I think you know what I'm talking about. All I want to see is these people in Alaska that get hurt at work get a fair chance. A lot of us twist wrenches and swing hammers and don't have the benefit of fancy chairs at work. I wish we did, but anyhow, this also applies to the fact that we're losing so many skilled workers in the construction trades, you know. Kids are watching their fathers and grandfathers and uncles go through exactly what I am right now. And I'll tell you what, if it wasn't for my parents having to delve into their retirement and keep me financially alive during this odd, unnecessary, completely ridiculous experience, and if it wasn't for the VA backing me up with that surgery, I will tell you, hand to God, I would be homeless and dead by now. And that is a fact. In the end, the only people that have come through for me are the Social Security disability and the federal government. And my injury date was 7/23/13, was my workers' comp injury. And I got an award letter from SSD. Guess what their award date was? 7/23/13, same date as my injury. I'm just throwing that out there. I thank you for your time, ladies and gentlemen. Have a good day and enjoy the sunshine. God bless you. Take care.
Thank you very much, Mr. Weaver. Does the Finance Committee have any questions for Mr. Weaver? Seeing none, I'd like to recognize that we've been joined by Representative Millettes. Thanks for being here. So is there anybody else in the room or online who would like to testify? Seeing none, let's take a brief at ease. Okay, House Finance is back on record. Commissioner Dragas or Ms. Marks, is there anything else that you would like to add before we set the bill aside, adjourn the meeting, and bring this back up at a later date? And by the way, amendments, we're asking those be due into my office with Jane Pearson by 5 p.m. on Friday, March 30th, 2018. And we are flexible on these things. I realize that this is pretty new, and I don't want to rush things. So, Representative Wilson?
Are we going to have them back before they're due? Because I honestly do not, there's still things I don't understand about this bill. They even feel like I could write an amendment at this point. I don't think it would be fair.
And Representative Wilson, I feel the same way, and I'm looking to my staff, and I think we can push this off. So we'll hold off on that amendment deadline, and we'll get back to the committee on this. So, Commissioner?
Yes, for the record, Heidi Dragas, Commissioner for the Department of Labor. I just want to thank the individuals who testified on this bill. Workers' compensation, I think all of us by now have come across workers' compensation bills. We have several from our department. Workers' compensation is a very difficult area of the law, and it really affects people personally. And it is about striking a balance and finding fairness for workers and efficiency and cost savings for employers. And that is not a difficult, that is a very difficult thing to balance. And I appreciate the gentleman from Unalaska's concerns about the workers' compensation system. We've attempted to address some of the efficiencies or increase efficiencies in the system through HB 79, which your body passed out earlier this session and is in the Senate. But, you know, there are areas that still need to be addressed about substantive benefits and other things. With respect to reemployment benefits, it is a difficult task to figure out what is the right balance that creates fairness for workers and for employers. And we did make a policy decision at the department and this administration to have a reemployment benefits process that is truly about reemployment and not about global settlements. And I appreciate the comments that we heard from other members, and I understand their viewpoints. And I think they're valid. What I want most to see is to see workers back in the workforce and not drawing down public assistance. And that's what I fear will happen when you settle out these types of benefits without an ability to track what they're using the settlement for. We don't have that ability at the department. We don't know what other people are doing besides the 14 people that continued through the process. So anyway, I just want to make sure that that was on the record. We're happy to work with any committee members on understanding the bill more. I know we met with several of you, and we'll continue to do that. So thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner. And if I did not close public testimony, we'll close public testimony. And so our next meeting is scheduled for Wednesday, March 28th at 1:30 p.m. That's tomorrow. And at that meeting, we will have an introduction and take public testimony on HB 219, which is criminal history check, state employees and contractors, HB 217, raw milk sales food exempt from regulations, HB 386, vessels, registration titles, derelicts, HGR 29, reauthorized Secure Rural Schools Act. And so is there anything else to come for the committee? Seeing none, we will be adjourned at 4:01 p.m. Thank you.